I'm Christopher Leiden with the scholar John Tierman at MIT, examining what we Americans don't much know about the civilian suffering and death in our wars abroad. The numbers, though they're huge, are never precisely certain. But maybe the real point is why we citizens have never asked to know them. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one starts with a pop quiz. How many people died in the Iraq War compared to Vietnam, compared to Korea, and World War II, and World War I, and the annexation of the Philippines at the turn of the 20th century? Not just Americans or American soldiers, but people. Some we were fighting against, some we were fighting to protect. Should all the casualties be counted on the scorecard that sums up the reality of a war? Can we accept General Tommy Franks' line about the invasion of Iraq that we don't do body counts? John Tierman's new book, coming from the Oxford University Press, is called The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. John Tierman, it seems to me worth saying that the book is not really about the military so much as it's about our history, our character, our ways of knowing, our media, our country, and what we care about. How different are we Americans, John Tierman, from the great powers that we know about in history, from Rome onward?
Well, I think all great powers, especially imperialist powers, have suffered the same kind of what I call a collective autism about civilian casualties in foreign wars. That is, that they simply don't pay attention, for the most part, to the damage and the devastation and the mortality that they create. I think our difference is, well, there are two differences and reasons to look at this more closely. One is that it's been the United States since 1945 that's mainly been involved in major conflicts. We've had wars, huge wars, in Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq, and a lot of smaller wars. We've supported others in wars, in the Reagan Doctrine and in other places. And altogether, then, the United States has been deeply involved for now 65 years in these massive conflicts. So that's one thing that is worth looking at. But I think we're also different for another reason. I used the work of Richard Slotkin and the frontier myth, which I think is a very compelling way of understanding this. And his point, his principal point in distinguishing the United States from Britain and France and the other great imperial powers of the 19th and 20th century is that we have what can be called a kind of a philosophy or a tendency to see violence in war as regenerative. That is, that it is something that actually makes us a better people in the end, that the acts of violence themselves are not merely redeeming something, redeeming a promise to liberate a country, to protect a country, to gain its bounty, but actually psychologically, morally is regenerative. And he, of course, he draws on the Puritan experience from this. But you can see this through the literature, through the cultural artifacts of the United States over 400 years.
Let me ask you about that, because you cite Lincoln and Walt Whitman with these enormously moving rhetorical justifications, in a sense, after the wars were over. This is God's justice. This is, in a sense, the glue of the nation going forward. Do these justifications, this redemptive side of it, come in after, or do you think during and before? My impression would be that the redemptive piece comes in afterward, not during or before. Or do you think it envelops the whole process?
I think it's both, actually. It can happen both during a war and after a war. Certainly after a war, there's always an attempt to justify what happened, even in wars that we have not done well in, Vietnam, Iraq, being the two most recent examples. I think we're going to begin to see this in Afghanistan as well. During the war, however, if you think about the beginning of the war in Iraq in 2003, a great deal of the sort of emotional pulse of the country was about regenerating ourselves from the horror and the trauma of 9/11. So it wasn't revenge exactly. It wasn't that there was a clear and present danger from Saddam Hussein. It was something almost spiritual in a way, that we were going to regenerate our manliness or our honor or our mission in the world through these acts of violence. It's never, of course, as explicit as that. People don't say we're going to rehabilitate ourselves morally through acts of violence. But it's that's the spirit of the war, and that happened at the beginning of the war, as it did to some extent in Vietnam for different reasons, as it did in Korea for different reasons. Interestingly enough, in wars that go badly, as those three did, the claim on this regenerative aspect of the war tends to diminish over time.
Could I ask you a little skeptically how you come to that conclusion that that's why we went? I mean, I didn't feel that we were regenerating ourselves in Iraq. I don't think you did. I don't know people who did. Nobody said it explicitly. It may well be true. But how would you prove that point, that as opposed to oil or remaking the Middle East or protecting Israel or whatever other of 1,000 reasons that were cited, why do you pick the one you do?
Well, it's not the only reason, obviously, and it is not the reason that is talked about very much. It's almost, I guess, below the surface. I think that it comes out mostly in the constant references to the frontier myth. Going back to Slotkin again, I think the Slotkin analysis is so compelling this way. We constantly frame these conflicts in terms of riding to the rescue of a beleaguered people, or extending our frontier into these misbegotten places. And this is tied up with a longstanding set of assumptions, cultural assumptions and beliefs about this country, that, for example, the continental expansion between the middle of the 17th century and the end of the 19th century was, in fact, justified not only in sort of material terms or manifest destiny terms, but this was constantly a way that we nourished our democratic values, our identity as a people, civilizing mission. These things constantly come into play in modern wars, too, and they tend to be given a shorthand. A shorthand is the sort of the cowboys and Indians shorthand, but it is definitely a part of the national consciousness.
Can I throw out an exception or maybe an objection to this general picture of an imperial tendency, big violence getting worse or continuing? Noam Chomsky remarked to us not that long ago that in fact there's a great deal of restraint on the weaponry, carpet bombing, for example, in Iraq or Afghanistan, that wasn't there 50 years ago in Southeast Asia?
Well, I would actually argue with my friend Noam about this on a couple of grounds. One is that I think that there was some learning in the U.S. military about the futility of that kind of bombing. I mean, we bombed North Korea, flattened North Korea over 3 years, basically, or after MacArthur retreated from the Yalu River, and we bombed heavily in North Vietnam, but not quite as much actually, and the damage was less. And there was, I think, a recognition that this kind of bombing didn't work that well ultimately. But also, Iraq was a very different kind of war. It wasn't divided between North and South. There wasn't a clear enemy. There was an enemy, is an enemy, but it is not one that you can find with B-52s. So there's that kind of strategic reason for doing that. But there's another reason that I think there's a war weariness that sets in much more quickly In fact, it was Chomsky who pointed this out around 2005, 2006, and that is that in the Iraq War, the American people turned against the war more quickly than they did during the Vietnam War. And they did so...
Even without an opposition movement. I mean, how do you account for a kind of... what even Chomsky would say is a kind of restraint?
Well, the kind of restraint I think I would agree with is a restraint based on the kind of mission they were trying to accomplish. Again, Iraq, very different from Vietnam in the military dimensions. But also this very rapid kind of disillusionment with the war. Remember, this was a war that was supposed to be over in a couple of months. It was a war that was supposed to be a cakewalk. All those things that the administration itself put out there as being their objectives and their expectations. So when that didn't happen, I think the American people, to a very significant degree, turned against it. And I think they turned against it also out of indifference, which is really a major theme in my book, and that is that it's not just that somehow we feel that the mission was wrong or that we're morally culpable or anything like that. It has to do with turning away from the carnage, not wanting to deal with it. Mm. And this kind of indifference translates into a decline in support of the war effort itself.
John Timmer, let me throw out a second general objection to the idea of collective autism and a kind of and the persistence of a very old pattern. Steve Pinker, the psychologist, child of MIT, is preaching a doctrine these days that we have as a species, in fact, become less violent. He would say this is the least violent moment in the history of humanity, the United States included. I mean, have you factored in that kind of view?
Well, that's a big claim. I wouldn't dispute it necessarily. And I think that if one looks at things like violent crime statistics in the United States and so on, that might be supportive of that. I'm not making the claim that the United States is out to start wars all over the world and to beat up the local populations. I'm saying that when these things have happened, when Korea and Vietnam and Iraq have, and now Afghanistan, have indeed become American wars, the treatment of civilians in those wars has been, in my view, disgraceful and forgotten both, or neglected. And that's really the point. It's not that we're out to be a violent people all over the world. I don't buy that if anyone is making that particular claim. But I think that when these wars happen, there are doctrines of war in the U.S. military of annihilating the enemy, of, you know, sort of take no prisoners attitude toward, you know, all operations, whatever they are. These result in massive civilian casualties. It results in enormous flows of refugees, 5 million displaced in Vietnam, 5 million displaced in Iraq. People homeless have still not gone back to their cities and towns. The effects of these wars are stupendous, and we simply don't acknowledge that that's the actual consequence on the ground. And that's the phenomenon that I am exploring.
Can you explain it? Pick a war, any war, maybe Korea, the forgotten war, in which what we forgot most of all were the casualties. Didn't know until years later, in fact, what we'd done. I still think we probably don't really carry it around with us. Or would you rather speak of Iraq?
Well, there are patterns in all three wars that I look at that are very, very similar in the sense that the military, of course, with the approval and encouragement of civilian leadership, runs a very violent war. In Korea, the war was particularly violent from the air. Again, the air bombardment was was daily, was flattened everything in North Korea. There was one comment from a general, it might have been LeMay, who said, "We didn't leave a building standing in North Korea." 3 million people died in Korea by the best estimates we have. 3 million people in 3 years. It was a three-year war. Many of them civilians. We still don't know how many. There are ways of framing the result of high civilian death, that allows people to sort of walk away from it. But I think it's a forgotten war in part because forgetting is a good way psychologically of dealing with it.
What about Iraq, where there are so many contradictions? President Bush didn't even want American caskets to be seen nor received at Andrews Air Force Base. This whole thing got pretty well. The media, it seemed to me, was hand in glove with him in covering up the reality of it. We spent a good deal of time with Nir Rosen, also Anthony Shadid, who did have an eye for the human reality on the ground. They could see the Iraqis as people almost none of the other coverage did. Sort it out. What's going on here?
Well, again, Iraq was a different war from the others, and I think that that difference is important in understanding the news media coverage. I mean, after all, Americans are very beholden to the news media for their information, right? It's not going to come reliably from the government.
But it may be changing, too. We'll get to that.
It's not reliably coming from others. There were very few NGOs that could operate there and so on. So it's mainly the news media, and the news media covers it. In the case of Iraq, many of them could not leave their bunkers in Baghdad. And the courageous ones, like Shadid and Nir Rosen, and a very small number of others, got out and saw a little bit more and reported it. It was, in that sense, very different from Vietnam, where you have a long list of very courageous and insightful reporters that were able to cover the war.
The Neil Sheehan, David Halberstam, Homer Bigot Brigade.
Right, exactly. And it's just extraordinary writing. And going back for this book, going back and reading some of that again, I'm struck by, on the one hand, how insightful they were. They could see the big picture in a way that I think a lot of journalists today have chosen not to. It's also in big contrast to Korea, where there was very little good reporting. There were a few good ones, but not very many. Vietnam may have been unique in that case. But in Iraq, of course, we have so many more means of communicating. We have television, much easier to film things now than it was in the 1960s or 70s. We have the internet. And still, the amount of intelligent, insightful, comprehensive coverage of the civilian issue is nearly non-existent. Mm. I'll give you one example of this that I found striking, and that is reading the Iraqis' blogs. Iraqis started up a lot of blogs after
right.
Saddam was gone.
Riverbend.
Riverbend being the most famous, but there were quite a few.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is a privileged group. I mean, I could only read the ones in English, and they tend to be educated young people. So it's a small demographic slice, but they talked about the effects on daily life of the war right. much more than you ever heard from anybody else. The new media in the United States, however, the Americans, I think contributed very little to our understanding of the war. There were a few people like Juan Cole, who reads Arabic, understands the history of the place, who could give very good commentary. But it was commentary rather than reporting. There was very little reporting. The new media contributed virtually nothing. And I think you can see
it contributed some famous war bloggers like Instapundit Glenn Reynolds at the University of Tennessee and notoriously Andrew Sullivan, who later repented, but he was certainly among the great war bloggers.
Well, there were commentators. There were a lot of comment. You know, there was a lot of opinion, but there was very little real information, new information, on the ground information coming into these coming through the internet. And I think you can see that the new media had very little influence in how Americans thought about the war. That is, if you look again at the polls about support or not supporting the war, it followed the same pattern of Vietnam and Korea. There
was virtually
no difference in the way people perceive the war, according to these polls, even though we have all these new means of communication. So that doesn't seem to be the key.
I asked you earlier sort of who did it differently. One thing that popped into my mind was that Saddam Hussein did it differently. His regime, ugly, brutal regime over many years in Iraq, kept meticulous records of the people they tortured, who did it, what they did to whom, and all of that stuff was preserved. What is it? What does that tell you about them and us that we can't get rid of the evidence fast enough?
Are there new trends out there, John Tierman, in the actual counting of these costs?
Yes, and it's a very interesting effort. I think the major difference from previous wars are these household surveys, in which you go out into the field and actually ask the Iraqis how many people they've lost, and then do a larger estimate. There are broad intervals, what we call confidence intervals in this, but it's the only way that you can get a very broad view of the society. In other words, those who count from newspapers or those who count from reports to U.S. military units, they don't know what they're missing. In other words, there's no way of knowing what you're not counting. Newspapers, English language newspapers, might or might not report all the civilian deaths that they know about. They may not have reporters everywhere that can report them. They may not know if someone's a civilian or an insurgent. They may not know about the back alley assassinations that seem to be very common in Iraq, revenge killings, and so on. There's just not very much reporting outside Baghdad that could give you those kinds of counts. And the way that the Iraqi health system, which was in shambles during most of the war, can report with death certificates and morgue counts and so on was also greatly diminished. A survey, on the other hand, is something that is what we call active surveillance. You go out and ask the question. And the limitation on it is that it's difficult to do this during wartime and get a very large randomized sample. So it's a very interesting – I won't go into the technical aspects of it any further, but it's a very interesting set of efforts to understand the scale and the nature of the killing. That is, even though I have my disputes with Iraq body count, it's a very sincere – effort to account for the dead and how they died. The same for the household surveys. And I think that the result of these, when one considers them together, is that the scale of killing was indeed very high. And this tells us something about the war. And it also tells us something about how we have neglected this aspect of the war. So, for example, just in the last month, I've noticed Anderson Cooper, an article in the New York Times, an article in the Boston Globe, all cited the lowest statistics feasible for deaths in Iraq. They described them in the tens of thousands. Hmm. Well, even Iraq body count, which counts them one by one and verifies them, is well over 100,000 now, and they believe they're off by at least a factor of two. The household surveys, which were taken in 2006, were already up 400,000, 600,000, both by direct violence and indirectly, structural violence, the loss of health care facilities and so on that result in higher numbers of deaths in the society. By now, the real number, of course, I say that sort of in quotation marks because we don't know the real number, but it, surely it's a, in the hundreds of thousands. And yet the news media constantly, I don't think through any malicious intent, but constantly cites this lower number. And I think that that's a real disservice to our understanding of what these wars are about.
A lot of what we haven't known, John Tierman, about foreign casualties in our wars reflects limitations on the media or maybe laziness or just cultural assumptions that we don't go there. I'd love you to reflect on the new media and the world ahead, where everybody's got a camera phone at all times. We're all linked. We're all in Facebook. Video networks are easy around the world. Bloggers did play a significant part in Iraq, etc. But how is the new hyperlinked, hypersensitized world going to tell us more?
Well, one of the interesting things that I found in researching this book is that some of the most vivid and striking accounts of the consequences for the civilian population in Iraq came through YouTube. The people, there are videographers out there who are interviewing people, who are occasionally catching a firefight or a bombing, the aftermath of a bombing. And I saw more on YouTube than I ever saw on network television or CNN or Fox or any of these major news media outlets that have presumably the capability of transmitting these images. So in that sense, I think the new world of new media can be very powerful. You know, let a thousand videographers bloom, and this is important, striking, sometimes very disturbing imagery that we're seeing. The same to some extent with the bloggers from Iraq, the occasional American and others who are reporting from there through the internet. But what I think is equally striking is that we don't see this on network and cable television, that we don't see it in the New York Times, that we don't see it on NPR and PBS. We're not seeing these things because I think there's a decision, whether conscious or unconscious, that it's not important, it's not credible, it's hard to understand the context, let's talk about something else. I really believe that that's part of what has happened. It's a kind of a cynical view on my part, but I think it's in keeping with this psychological explanation of avoidance that is so prevalent in all these situations.
Come back, though, to the psychology. It is about what we don't want to know and don't turn the page to find out. And there's so many contradictions in it, including the fact that Time magazine will show an Afghan woman who's lost her nose to the Taliban. These are the helpless civilians that were there to help, and yet we don't count the ones that, our drones blew up. How do you deal with a person, a country, in a way, that's in that kind of denial?
Well, again, the Afghan war is a tricky one. It's complex. There has been a bigger effort not to harm civilians there, I think, than there was in Iraq, in part because of the history of occupation. And in Iraq, as late as I believe it was 2007 or 2008, after a tremendous amount of killing had occurred, one pollster, I think, out of all the polls taken about Iraq, one pollster in the United States asked Americans, how many people do you think have died in Iraq? How many civilians? And how many U.S. soldiers? The response was very accurate on the number of U.S. military deaths. But on Iraqis, at a time when probably hundreds of thousands had already died, the answer was, I believe, 9,000, which is an indication both of lack of interest and of, I think, a kind of a superficiality of reporting.
Yeah. The wisdom of crowds does not apply They could count the beans in a bowl better than they could estimate or guesstimate.
Right.
The Iraqi did.
So it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, there is information on the internet. There is information on YouTube. There is information from NGOs and academics and so on. But we're not, as a people, we're not really interested in knowing this information. I think that's the kind of saddening conclusion that I'm led to.
It leads me to the main question I had reading your book, John Tierman, which is, what of the countervailing pragmatic tradition that we prize in Americans? Does something work? It's the William James test. An idea is only as good as its results. An idea that has bad results is a bad idea. The Civil War was a bad idea. Let's figure a better way. Let's test it against what actually happened. It's vital to have a composite scorecard of the whole story. And it would seem to me Americans above all would want to have one.
I say in the book, and I think this is an important point, that failure in war, failure to achieve objectives as stated at the outset of the war, which was true in Korea, was a little muddled, but the war was considered to be a failure in many respects. Vietnam, certainly a failure. Iraq, I think most people feel it was a failure, certainly a failure on the grounds that it was argued for by the president. But we deal actually pretty well with failure in a particular way. That is, that failure can be explained as, well, we'll do better the next time. We will learn from this failure. Maybe we had some bad luck. We miscalculated a little. The enemy was tougher than we thought. They got aid from other enemies. You know, in other words, there are ways in which journalists and academics and others argue about failure and what we could do better the next time. The military is famous for lessons learned. They're very good at it in conflict. What we don't want to deal with is moral failure. We don't want to deal with immorality in our intentions or in the execution of a war. So that's one of the reasons, I think, we don't talk about civilian deaths and civilian injuries and devastation and refugees. We don't talk about it because there's no way to account for that that is pleasing to ourselves. It's an odd thing that we can talk about failure, about war objectives and how we're going to do better the next time and so on, in a kind of sort of dispassionate way. But we don't want to talk at all about the moral failure of what we've actually done to that country.
John Tierman, how does your general idea of a persistent pattern of ignoring the worst human effects, how does that deal with the Petraeus Doctrine, which is that the first rule in Afghanistan now, say, is protect the population? Is this a lie? Is it a trend? Have they turned a page in the way we think about war and casualties and civilian dead as a kind of one whole package?
Well, you would think they would have learned from Vietnam, and they didn't. And I wonder about, there's a kind of a love of counterinsurgency doctrine among many in the military.
It comes and goes, doesn't it?
Well, it does come and go. You see this a lot in academia, too. And it becomes a kind of a holy grail, I guess, is the right image. You can never quite get there. Counterinsurgency is very hard to do for lots of reasons. And we tried it in Vietnam, did it very badly. Had, in effect, the same consequences by driving people in the South into the arms of the Viet Cong, so to speak. But in Iraq, the attempt at counterinsurgency, you would think that they would have learned something from Vietnam. on how many troops you need, how much support you need in the villages that you are supposedly in control of, and so on. I think that there was a mismatch in doctrine as well as in manpower, and that the military was constrained by the civilian leadership. They could only supply 500,000 troops if there was a draft. It was a non-starter for Rumsfeld and the others in the Bush administration, and therefore counterinsurgency at any stage in the war then became less and less feasible. And as I said, they substituted firepower for boots on the ground, and the result was the smoking ruin that Iraq became.
John Tierman, look ahead past 2012. What's the trend here? In a world that is absolutely saturated with information, but has this blinker on, where are we going? And how will it affect, you know, the course of foreign and military policy next year?
So to me, the question is, or the answer and the question is, the answer in the short term is that I think there's war fatigue and we're going to have fewer of these kinds of wars. These savage wars for peace, as I think ironically was once these were once described, but we forget what happened. We forget how traumatic they were for ourselves, much less traumatic for the people that we were there supposedly to help. And 10 years from now, 12 years from now, some politician needs a nifty little war to boost his or her fortunes. Who knows? Will be involved somewhere else. I'm not very optimistic on that score. I am optimistic about Americans being somewhat realistic about these things and wanting to question them. But I'm much less optimistic about political leadership. How much are we going to examine, for example, what happened in Iraq? How much is the Democratic leadership? Republicans don't want to talk about it because it was their war, really. They insisted on it. They lied about it. And they're not going to want to examine it. Will Obama or his successor or the Senate leadership, the major liberal newspapers, are they going to really examine what happened over this period of time? I'm doubtful.
John Tierman, thank you very much for this book, The Deaths of Others, The Fate of Civilians in America's Wars. And thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.